From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump has arrived in Hamburg, Germany to meet with world leaders for the G20 summit. The president started the day in Warsaw, Poland, where he gave his first public European speech to cheering crowds. He also held a joint press conference with Polish President Andrzej Duda and addressed North Korea's long-range missile test earlier this week.
As far as North Korea is concerned, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I don't like to talk about what I have planned, but I have some pretty severe things that we're thinking about. That doesn't mean we're going to do them. I don't draw red lines.
Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. And Tamara, we heard Trump say that he's planning some pretty severe things for North Korea, but he won't give details. How is the world supposed to interpret that?
But he won't give details is a perfect phrase for many things involving the Trump administration, and in particular involving President Trump's approach to military operations of any kind. He likes to say that he doesn't like to, forecast what he may or may not do. And so there are no doubt he's been getting briefings. There have been discussions about the options that are available. And you've discussed those options on this program. There aren't a lot of great ones. But he's not letting on what they might be contemplating. And that's pretty standard for President Trump.
Right. Although the phrase pretty severe things just sort of hangs there in the air. Right.
It does, in fact.
Yeah.
Hang there.
Yeah. Well, in his speech in Warsaw today, he was well received by a large crowd. Many of those in the crowd were bussed in from the countryside to hear it. Here's one of the key moments.
The fundamental question of our time is whether the West has the will to survive. Do we have the confidence in our values to defend them at any cost? Do we have enough respect for our citizens to protect our borders? Do we have the desire and the courage to preserve our civilization in the face of those who would subvert and destroy it?
So people talking about the tone of that message, a little dark, I guess you could say. What's significant about it?
Yeah, and that's in line with some of the dark tone that the president often brings when discussing ISIS and sort of the war of civilizations that he sees in the fight against terrorism, or as he likes to say, radical Islamic terrorism. Other things, though, that he did talk about was he pushed back on Russia a little bit. He also talked about the mutual defense agreement with NATO. So although there was a dark tone in part of the speech, he also said a lot of the things that outside observers said that the president needed to say.
Yeah. In fact, let's hear some of that part of the speech where he criticizes Russia.
We urge Russia to cease its destabilizing activities in Ukraine and elsewhere, and its support for hostile regimes, including Syria and Iran.
Tamara, it sounds a little bit like this is a direct nod in part to the audience that he's speaking to there in Poland. Is that right?
Well, and also, he was in Poland, which is not far from Russia.
Yeah.
And Poland has felt a lot of pressure from Russia. And this is ahead of his meeting with Vladimir Putin that's coming tomorrow. There is significance in the choice to go to Poland before going to the G20, before meeting with Putin, to say, and to stand there and reaffirm Article 5, the Mutual Defense Treaty.
We've all been wondering what this speech with Putin will be like if the president has an agenda going into the meeting. We talked about that yesterday. Is what we heard just now, and also the fact that at a press conference this morning in Poland, Trump still would not unequivocally say that Russia meddled in the 2016 election. I just wonder if today has given us any hint into how he's going to approach that meeting with Putin tomorrow.
Yeah, and I had heard a quote from a Kremlin spokesman saying, we still don't know what the U.S. wants. I mean, there really is a mixed message there. On one hand, President Trump and the Trump administration are taking a very hard line on what they describe as destabilizing activities in Ukraine and elsewhere, a hard line on Russian support for Syria and Iran. But then at the same time, the president has sort of steadfastly refused to fully commit to the idea that Russia meddled in the U.S. election. Once again, in this press conference, he said it could have been Russia. I think it was Russia or a lot of other people. A lot of people in countries have been meddling. And then at one point, he turned to blame President Obama for not doing enough. But he had this really weird turn of phrase where he says Obama, when he was president, found out about this in terms of if it were Russia, never like fully committing in that sentence right. to what the intelligence community has said.
All right, we're going to keep an eye on that meeting with Vladimir Putin for sure. That's NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tamara, thank you.
You're welcome.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us now from Moscow to look ahead to that meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. We don't know, Sarah, what President Trump hopes to accomplish out of the meeting because he's not saying. What has Vladimir Putin said in the lead up to the session, and what does he want to come out of it?
Well, he personally said very little, but his spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, from the Kremlin, we speak to him daily, and for the last few days, that's precisely what we've been asking him. And he's pretty much playing down expectations, I think it's fair to say. Russia is presenting this as an opportunity for the two men to sit down face-to-face for the first time and to try to figure out where their relationship goes. I think Russia really does want to try to improve relations, but I think Russia's not going into this offering lots of concessions in terms of its behavior. So I think this is very much Moscow seeing this as a get-to-know-you session, feeling out Donald Trump and President Putin really going in there to look him in the eye and to see who this man is and what possibly the relationship with him can be. And of course, there's been so much speculation about it in the lead up to it that I think even the body language is what everyone will be watching.
How realistic is it that this would be kind of a get-to-know-you session, given the fact that there are so many differences between the two countries right now? And we have on the table U.S. intelligence finding that Russia has interfered in the U.S. election, even though President Trump has questioned that. And also they have great differences on Syria and Ukraine. So could it be that those things are left to the side as these two meet?
There's so many questions, aren't there? There's so much riding on this, if you like. I think there are huge differences in policy, obviously, between the two countries, between the two presidents. I don't think Russia is going in this preparing to step back on any of its key positions, which are that it supports President Assad in Syria, that it its position on Ukraine is clear about the talks there that Russia is involved in towards resolving the conflict in Ukraine, but again saying that Russia is not involved in the conflict there. There are some things that Russia would like to see change. It would like to see an end to sanctions against Russia for what's happened in Ukraine. It would like to see a couple of diplomatic compounds that have been seized in the United States returned. So there are some things that Russia wants to get from this. But I think, as I say, it's not going to make big concessions. So I think the hope from President Putin is that it will be about feeling out Donald Trump. I think President Putin won't give very much away either. I think he's a very cool cookie. He's used to these kind of meetings, and perhaps he's waiting to see what moves Donald Trump makes before he reveals his hand too much.
One of the other main issues that is bound to come up is North Korea right now. Could Russia play, and is Vladimir Putin intending to play any further role in trying to diffuse the tensions there?
Well, there is a deal on the table which Russia and China have signed up to, whereby Russia and China are saying that they are calling on North Korea to end their missile tests and simultaneously for the United States and South Korea to end further military exercises in that region. So that's the deal that Russia and China are putting on the table. The question is, of course, whether or not China has much leverage or is prepared to use that leverage with North Korea. Russia is certainly very concerned about the potential for a military escalation of what's happening there in Korea. So I think Russia is trying to present itself at least as part of the solution. I think that's part of a broader picture here for Vladimir Putin. He wants to be seen as a big player globally. He wants to be seen as involved in these big questions. And Russia does have a clear position on North Korea. So certainly it is something that perhaps the two men could talk about in concrete terms without too much disagreement.
Sarah, there are concerns here that since Donald Trump is going into this meeting with Vladimir Putin without an agenda, that's what President Trump has said, that it'll be Vladimir Putin who comes in and sets the agenda. I wonder, though, from your perspective in Moscow, what the perception is of the power dynamic between these two people, between Trump and Putin?
I think people here are expecting President Putin, in a way, to sit back and let Donald Trump make the moves and watch and see how it goes. Because Mr. Putin, as I say, is very experienced. He's very cool. He's very level-headed. He's a calculating man. It's often mentioned that he's a former KGB man, and that is a fact. I mean, he comes from that background. Donald Trump, as we know, is impulsive and liable to go off script. And so I think, in a way, Russia feels it's going into this with all the cards in terms of conduct, if you like, in its hand. It feels that President Putin will be able to manage this encounter fairly well. And I think the recent comments by Donald Trump in Poland that we've heard today, for example, have left Moscow feeling quite comfortable. Donald Trump did not come out categorically and say that Russia was responsible for interfering in the US elections. He said it could have been some other country. So Russia shrugged that off. And I think, you know, I don't think President Putin is expecting to have too tough a time when he meets Donald Trump. And I think if he does, then he is prepared for it.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So you're looking for a movie that isn't the latest iteration of the Transformers, Pirates of the Caribbean, or Despicable Me franchises? If so, Claudia Puig has some suggestions for you. Claudia is president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Claudia, thank you very much for rescuing us from the summer retread circuit.
My pleasure.
So, Claudia, start with a film that opened this past week, Baby Driver. It stars Ansel Elgort, of Fault in Our Stars fame, as a wunderkind driver who gets lured in as a wheelman for various heists. We've got a clip of it now. In this scene, he meets a curious waitress at a diner. The waitress is played by Lily James.
So what is it you do?
I'm a driver.
Oh, like a chauffeur. You drive around important people.
I guess I do.
Anyone I'd know?
I hope not.
Well, aren't you mysterious?
Maybe.
Maybe?
This is really the blast of energy that we need to kick the summer movie season into high gear. I think that this is definitely the film for people who think they've seen every kind of car chase that's already been done. They'll see new ones. And these are choreographed to music. So it's like an action musical. Edgar Wright, the director, syncs up the visuals with these perfectly calibrated beats of car chases and rhythms. And even the dialogue is kind of syncopated.
And so you're seeing, you know, some of the other stars, John Hamm, Kevin Spacey, or Jamie Foxx, are they all, you know, belting it out?
Oh, no, they don't sing. Nobody's singing. It's an action movie, a heist caper to a musical soundtrack, so that the movements and the car chases are to a very eclectic musical score.
So I like the pair-up, at least in theory, you can tell us in practice, of actress Salma Hayek and John Lithgow. They're in a film, Beatriz at Dinner. Hayek is a Mexican-American practitioner of alternative medicine, and she meets up with a man named Doug, who is a self-important billionaire. They met up at a client's party. Here's a scene where they really hit it off.
Well, when I first came to the United States a long time ago...
Did you come legally?
Yes.
Now, how'd that work?
I had family here on my mother's side. My grandmother died and...
They're all citizens or...
Ah, Doug, what, you work for the INS? You're grilling her.
I'm curious. A lot of people come here illegally. I was interested in how she did it.
Okay. Oh, you just see the sparks flying. What a future they have together. How'd you like it, Claudia?
I liked it. It's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. There are moments where you're kind of squirming like that. But I think it's the kind of squirming that perhaps we need to be doing these days. Watching it will, I think it, we had some great conversations, my husband and I, afterwards. And I just think that, you know, it will definitely kick off a lot of interesting discussion afterwards. It's timely.
It's timely. And actually, let me ask you about that. I mean, is it timely with the intent on being some kind of contemporary social commentary, or is it too soon?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's not patterned after our president or anyone that we know particularly. It was done before he became president. And so the director, Miguel Arteta, who worked with Mike White, they did Chuck and Buck. He's been very quick to point out that it's not about him per se, the president, but it's about our increasingly polarized society. And I think it's fascinating, it's relatable, it's thought-provoking as a mirror of where we currently stand. And also, I think it's Hayek's best performance. It may earn her an Oscar nomination, and Lithgow as well. They're both excellent.
Beatrice at Dinner has a really contemporary feel. The next film we want you to talk about is based on a 14th century work. Tell us about The Little Hours.
This is just a hoot. This is nuns behaving badly or maybe acting like bratty millennials. It's based on the Decameron, the 14th century work, but the jokes and the attitude is 21st century. It's very irreverent, extremely irreverent. I understand that clips cannot be played on the air because it's so irreverent, but it's very funny. And you have some fantastic comic actors in it. The three nuns, young nuns, are played by Aubrey Plaza, Alison Brew, and Kate Micucci. They're ill-tempered, they're gossipy, they're anything but God-fearing or, you know, holy. And then Dave Franco, who is this very attractive young man, comes into their midst and lust ensues. And then there's the Mother Superior, who is played by Molly Shannon. John C. Reilly plays this kind of bumbling priest who's assigned to the convent. And then you have others like Nick Offerman.
This is a great cast.
It's a fantastic cast. It's a really, really funny movie. Just hearing him say the word Guelph, remember that. he goes on these tirades against the invading Guelphs. And just, you know, that word alone will make you giggle. And it's shot on location in Tuscany, so it's beautiful on top of everything else. So I thought it was a lot of fun. I loved it.
That's The Little Hours. Claudia, summertime isn't usually the time for movies that would be considered Oscar contenders. But you've got a couple of films you think we might be hearing about around nomination time. Let's begin with one by Sofia Coppola. The Beguiled, which is set during the Civil War. It stars Nicole Kidman as the head of a girls' school in Virginia. We're going to listen to a little bit of it right now. In this scene, one of her students has come across a wounded Union soldier and brought him back to the school.
How did he get here?
He was all alone in the woods. I couldn't leave him there to die.
You know you're not supposed to go that far.
Is he dead?
No, not yet. Quick, we need to move him to the port.
Like The Little Hours, this is also about several women for whom lust rises when a man comes into their midst. Nicole Kidman runs the school. Kirsten Dunst is a teacher. Elle Fanning is a student. Colin Farrell is the Union soldier who is wounded, who comes into their midst. This is a very sort of slowly simmering atmospheric thriller. It has kind of a Southern Gothic mood of ominous beauty. It's gorgeous, the production design, the costumes. And there's a sense of sort of simmering tension. You hear natural sounds. There's very little soundtrack, which is also, it really heightens the mood. You hear crickets chirping, and then you see this visual beauty. It's very well acted as an ensemble drama, and I think it's very effective as an atmospheric thriller.
Tell us about the Pakistani-American comedian Kumail Nanjiani, who has an autobiographical film called The Big Sick that's written by Nanjiani and his wife, Emily Gordon, about the early part of their relationship. Here's a scene where the two first meet. Emily is played by Zoe Kazan, is in the audience at one of Kumail's shows, and he approaches her afterwards.
I have to tell you that when you yelled at me, it really threw me off, and you really shouldn't heckle comedians. It's so rude.
I didn't heckle you. I just woo-hooed you. It's supportive.
Okay, that's a common misconception. Uh-huh. But yelling anything at a comedian is considered heckling. Heckling doesn't have to be negative.
So if I yelled out, like, you're amazing in bed, that'd be a heckle?
Yeah, it would be an accurate heckle.
Well, things aren't going too well there, but it's called The Big Sick, so I think that things go probably worse, huh?
They go worse before they get better, yes. This is a charming film. I think it's hard to imagine a more charming movie this year, maybe any, you know, in the last 5 years. It's the perfect blend of wit and heart and tenderness and intelligence and toughness. It really has an authentic feel. It touches also on, I think, rather timely territory, you know, because he is Pakistani-American. His family wants him to have an arranged marriage. He even makes some jokes about what it's like to be a Muslim in America today. And then also it has this extra added element. Holly Hunter and Ray Romano play her parents. She falls into a coma. This is not giving anything away. They've been out talking about this, and I think it's featured in the trailer. She falls into a coma, and so her parents come to sit by her bedside, and he's there as well. So it's also a little bit about his relationship with her parents. And that's something you don't see in many movies. I mean, you see Meet the Parents, you see sort of the comic exaggeration of those relationships, but you don't see it, depict in any kind of honesty. So there's a lot going on here, and it's wonderful. It's one of my favorite movies of the year.
That's The Big Sick. We want to leave you time to talk about one more film that you have seen, Okja, O-K-J-A, by the famed Korean director Bong Joon-ho. Tell us about it.
I really like this film. It's very offbeat, and I'm a big fan of Bong Joon-ho. I liked Snowpiercer a lot. I liked Mother, or The Host. This is different from all those films. It has been compared a little bit to E.T. in that it has a young girl and her beloved pig. But the pig is this massive animal that's been genetically modified and looks more like a hippo, actually, and with very soulful eyes and a very, very sweet face. And there's this multinational conglomerate that's headed up by Tilda Swinton, and she's really great in the role. It's kind of a role she was born to play, this very arch character. It's a family-owned multinational corporation that decides it wants to create these genetically modified animals for eventual slaughter and food. And so what they do is they disperse these animals around the globe to various farms and have them be raised for 10 years. So, of course, this girl bonded with her pet pig. And it's what ensues when they want to take the pig back. And she sets out on this rescue mission to make sure that they don't take the pig. It's on Netflix, so it's available to everybody.
Great. And just taking one step back, Claudia, is there kind of a theme to the films that you're seeing out right now for the summertime? Is there something that kind of unifies them or that's distinctly separating them?
Well, I would say that these particular films that we've just discussed, these half dozen films, all kind of have a timeliness factor. I mean, when you talk about Okja, you're talking about corporate America. And then in The Big Sick, you're talking about, you know, a cross-cultural romantic relationship. And also in Beatrice at Dinner, you're dealing with immigration and some very important timely cultural issues. So I would say all of these. And then they're quite female centric. The Little Hours centers around three women. The Beguiled is all about women and sort of how they deal with their various emotions and with lust. So I think there's a very kind of contemporary feel to all of these, even the one that's set in the 14th century. They're all dealing with current issues.
Thank you very much. We've been talking summer films that aren't quite sequels with Claudia Puig, president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and we'll have all of Claudia's picks at hereandnow.org. So nice to talk to you. Thank you, Claudia.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions, and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
Baseball is headed into its final weekend before the All-Star break on Tuesday. The game will be in Miami, and this year the stakes are going to be a lot lower because the winner of the game will no longer be guaranteed home field advantage in the World Series. Mike Pesca is Here and Now's sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he's here to talk about the first half of the baseball season. Mike, hello.
Hello, I like your marketing idea. The stakes have never been lower. Come tune in.
So why watch, right? I mean, right, why watch? It's just for fun now, I guess, huh?
It was really always just for fun. Here's the deal with the All-Star game. They changed the rules after there was a tie. What? There's no tying or crying in baseball, but there was back in, I think, 2003. And so they put so-called stakes on the line, which was the winner of the All-Star game would get that league, would host the World Series. But it just didn't change. I'm not going to say it didn't change anything. It didn't change much. Hmm. It reined in perhaps the most outrageous examples of players treating it as an exhibition, but by a number of empirical metrics, like how often substitutions were made, right? If managers really, really wanted to win, they'd keep their best players in. But that's not how this game went, or it didn't change at all. So it's really going to be the same game that we are used to, which is an exhibition and a nice break in the summer.
Sure. One of the big stories in the first half of the year has been that home runs are just flying out of the parks at a record pace. And one of the guys responsible for that is a rookie who plays for the Yankees. His name is Aaron Judge. I guess he'll be playing this week at the All-Star game. Tell us about him.
Yeah, 29 home runs, leads Major League Baseball. He just tied Joe DiMaggio for the rookie home run record. You've heard of him, Joe DiMaggio. Yeah.
Jolton Joe.
Aaron Judge not only hits home runs, he hits monstrous, towering, thunderous home runs. They don't count more than just the ones that are the scraping the back wall, but they're amazing to watch. And he has, last year the Yankees had a catcher, Gary Sanchez, who set home run records for a catcher. Now they have this guy who's setting home run records. He's gigantic. He's compelling to watch. He's one of the great stories of baseball.
He's obviously in the American League. Over in the National League, the story seems to be that it's the National League West versus everyone else.
Yes, yes. They have three of the teams with above a 55%, let's say, winning percentage. I think the Dodgers will be the class of that division, and presumably anything could happen in the playoffs. They're the favorites to go to the World Series. As far as National League players, there's not an equivalent. He's not as good as Judge or hasn't put up the numbers, but Clay Bellinger of the Dodgers. I'm sorry, Clay was the father. Cody Bellinger of the Dodgers has 24 home runs in his rookie season, was hitting one every day for a while. He's an amazing story. And I would say after Judge, about the five or six next best hitters in baseball are all in the National League. Joey Votto, Bryce Harper, Paul Goldschmidt, Ryan Zimmerman, Daniel Murphy. I could just tick down names. That'd be exciting radio.
It will be exciting to watch them hit home runs during the Home Run Derby, though. Switching sports, you and I recently spoke about the NBA draft. I know you're still keeping an eye on NBA free agents. What are you watching for there quickly?
Wow, it's pretty amazing. Boston signed Utah's Gordon Hayward. There is talk, and it's plausible, that Carmelo Anthony, a great player, maybe even a Hall of Famer, could join the Cleveland Cavaliers, perhaps replacing Kevin Love. Mm. That could change the balance of power. Most of the great players have gone to the West. What if he goes to Cleveland? That could be cool.
All right. Yeah, cool. Mike Pesca is here and now, sports analyst. He's also the host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
President Trump's first high-level meeting today in Hamburg, Germany, is with the host of the upcoming G20 summit, German Chancellor Angela Merkel. The two have tangled over policy. The White House says the president looks forward to helping Chancellor Merkel make the summit a success. Merkel is downplaying expectations that the U.S. and Germany can surmount their differences, and there are many differences on defense spending, trade, and climate change. Esme Nicholson has our report.
In Berlin, the U.S. Embassy sits in prime position, right next to the Brandenburg Gate. Former U.S. Presidents Reagan, Clinton, and Obama have all spoken in front of the famous landmark. But since Merkel suggested in a campaign speech that Europe can no longer fully rely on America, and since Trump announced his withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord, the star-spangled banner outside the embassy flies in what some profess to be the wind of change. Sheltering from that wind under the Brandenburg Gate is 66-year-old Edgar Ganter.
Ich finde, wir haben uns viel zu lange und zu lasch auf Amerika verlassen.
We've depended on America for military support for far too long. We're used to thinking that Americans will straighten everything out. That's a mistake.
58-year-old Christina Willeker agrees, but she also takes umbrage at Trump's angry tweets about Germany's export surplus.
Ja, das liegt so an den Amerikanern. Die konsumieren einfach zu viel und können nicht genug.
It's not our fault. We work for it with our own hands. If the Americans stopped consuming so much and started producing more, maybe they'd see some export success too.
U.S.-German relations are not as warm as they once were. On Monday, Angela Merkel's conservative Christian Democrat Party launched its campaign manifesto for September's election. In it, the United States is no longer referred to as a friend, but as a mere partner. The Social Democrats have been less cautious in voicing their unease about the president. Their chancellor candidate, Martin Schulz, called Trump the destroyer of all Western values after the G7 summit in May. But neither party has addressed Trump's repeated criticism of Germany's trade deficit.
If you want to win the elections in Germany, it's better not to touch the export surpluses. They are the holy grail of German politics.
Ulrike Herrmann is the economics editor of the left-leaning Taz newspaper.
Germans are told that their export surpluses are no problem. And Germans just refuse to understand that you can have export surpluses only if there's someone else having deficits.
Herrmann says Merkel's objection to Trump's America First policy is ironic, because when it comes to trade, it's all about Germany first. What's more, she says Merkel's campaign rhetoric about dwindling transatlantic relations, now written into her party manifesto, is really about Merkel first. Trump is deeply disliked by the German electorate. Criticizing him wins votes. But Merkel is an ardent Atlanticist. After the president pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, the chancellor appeared to snub Trump, but not America, by saying that she was touched and thrilled to see how many US corporations and politicians are still committed to it. Back at the Brandenburg Gate, angry Berliners protest against Trump's climate policy. The US Embassy's address here is number 2 Paris Square, somewhat ironic in light of current circumstances. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
The case of a 10-month-old British boy is gaining attention around the world after both President Trump and the Pope tweeted about it this week. The infant is Charlie Gard. He was born with an extremely rare genetic condition. It's called mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome. He's been getting treatment in a British hospital for months, but now the hospital says it can't do anything more to help Charlie and that it's time to take him off life support. His parents want to keep him alive and bring him to the U.S. for experimental treatment. British courts have decided in favor of the hospital, finding that further treatment won't help Charlie. Sharon Begley is a senior science writer for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. She's on Skype. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Lisa.
How rare is this disease?
Oh, it's extremely rare. There are only 15 other cases reported in the medical literature. So Charlie is number 16 known in the entire world.
Known to have it now or have had it at ever. All? Ever.
Exactly. Of course, it's possible that before the age of modern medicine, other people had it. They must have because it's a genetic mutation, which is present in a very, very few, fewer than a percent of the human population. But it's been recognized only 15 previous times out of a population of nearly 7 billion.
What do we know about what it does to the body?
It's extremely serious. Children who are born with it rarely live beyond a year or two. So the name, again, mitochondrial DNA depletion. So just to unpack that, mitochondria are tiny microscopic structures within our cells. Their main function is to produce energy. If the mitochondria are not functioning properly, our cells basically don't function either. So that is especially true of muscle cells. As a result, children with this syndrome lose the ability to even hold their heads up. Their muscles do not function. Muscles, of course, are also involved in respiration. They lose their ability to breathe on their own. Charlie is therefore on a ventilator, and they cannot eat on their own. So Charlie is being fed through a tube. And it also has repercussions for the brain, for the kidneys, and eventually all of the organs shut down because no organ can survive without energy.
Charlie initially had those capabilities, though, of breathing on his own, eating on his own?
He did. When he was born, he seemed okay. And the reason is that when we are born, even if you have this rare disorder, your cells have a little sort of reserve of energy, and they are able to function for at least a few months. But very quickly, it becomes apparent that the child is not growing, not meeting those milestones, and loses muscle tone. So the children go downhill very, very quickly. And that's what Charlie's parents noticed in him. It typically takes quite a medical odyssey to get a diagnosis, again, because it's so extremely rare. It's hardly the first thing that physicians look for when they're trying to figure out what has gone wrong. But Charlie eventually did receive a diagnosis of mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome, and more specifically, his is a form called RRM2B, again, extremely rare.
As this battle goes on about whether Charlie should stay on life support, the hospital wants life support withdrawn, saying there's nothing else they can do for him. The parents' interest in going abroad, coming to the United States to try and get some experimental treatment for Charlie. As that all happens, is Charlie's condition changing?
As long as he is on life support, he is basically being, you know, sustained. The argument that the hospital made before a number of judicial bodies in the United Kingdom and then in Europe are that he might be suffering and that he really has no life now. He has perhaps an existence. But as you said, Lisa, there is at least the tiny possibility of an experimental treatment. And I spoke to a father whose son also has mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome. But crucially, in the case of that child, an American boy who lives in the Washington, D.C. area, his syndrome is caused by a different mutation. So even the tiny little hope that helped this American child is probably not there for Charlie. Again, different mutations lead to the same syndrome, but because of the way that different mutations act, it's much less likely that this experimental intervention, which seems to be working for the American child, has even less of a chance of working for Charlie Gard.
I wonder at what point then a disease becomes subject to aggressive research. I mean, is there any hope for a treatment or a cure eventually? When we're talking about a condition or a disease that only 16 people have had.
There's no question that because the syndrome is so, so rare, there simply has been less of a push by, you know, just civilians, by families and others who are affected by it because there are too few of them. I mean, this is not Alzheimer's disease. This is not breast cancer. But again, to their credit, there are a small number of researchers working by and large in academic labs who have taken it on. And there have been some glimmers of hope. Again, we're very, very far away from any sort of treatment that can be offered to patients outside of studies, outside of experiments, but at least some research is going on.
Good to talk to you about this case. Sharon Begley, senior science writer for our partners at STAT. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa.
Forest fires continue to burn in the western United States, including one in Breckenridge, Colorado, home to the Breckenridge Ski Resort. More than 450 homes have been evacuated in an area covering about 80 acres. A dense section of dead trees killed off by bark beetles helped ignite the fire. Here's evacuee Scott Fines speaking to the Denver Post.
We grabbed our computers with our photos, grabbed their cameras, grabbed their dogs, grabbed our passports. We were fine. That's all we really care about.
The ski resort is just a few miles from the fire, but it has not yet been evacuated. Wind gusts last night helped push the fire back to an area where it had already been burning. Fires are also charring forests in Nevada, California, Arizona, and Wyoming. And there's one in Washington State that's been burning since Sunday. That fire is close to a decommissioned nuclear weapon production facility, but so far the site has not been threatened. And along with fire, warm weather also brings mosquitoes and earnest public health campaigns like this one from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Zika mainly spreads to people through the bite of an infected Aedes aegypti or Aedes albopictus mosquito.
All right, kind of a snooze, right? Well, in Fairfax County, Virginia, one mosquito expert is trying to liven up the message. Jacob Fenston of Here and Now contributor WAMU has this story about a man known as MC Bugsy.
At the height of the Zika scare last summer, Andy Lima was working on a video about prevention. He already knew all the information he needed to squeeze into it. He was busy thinking about beats and rhymes.
When Zika came along, I don't know, it just kind of popped with mosquito. Yo, don't get sick with Zika from the bite of a mosquito. Prevention. And then the rest of the song writes itself if you're getting the prevention messaging in. Empty water from containers and dress to protect. When you feed them, you breed them, so wear approved propellant. The gene is 80s, has some ladies with importance indeed. Yellow fever, chikungunya, Zika, or dengue. Beware of 80s, albopictus, and Egypti. These are some species you should care about.
Those Latin species and genus names roll off Lima's tongue because he's got plenty of practice saying them. By day, Lima is a mosquito biologist at the Fairfax County Health Department, but when he's off the clock, he's MC Bugsy, rapping about insects and the illnesses they spread. Fever, rash, joint pain, and conjunctivitis are common symptoms of infection with the Zika virus. His track Zika 101 came out last August, around the same time officials were racing to contain the first local outbreak of the disease in the U.S. in South Florida. So far this year, there have been no cases of Zika in the U.S. spread by local mosquitoes, but there is still a danger. The main mosquito spreading the virus is found in counties across the country from Connecticut to California. Last year, the Aedes aegypti's range grew by 21%. That's why part of Lima's job at the health department is to trap mosquitoes and test them for Zika and other diseases.
All right, so first things first, put up the rain guard.
He's showing me how to set up a trap at a testing site behind his office.
So that cartridge just goes into the top of our trap here.
Another big part of Lima's job is education, and he says music with lyrics that get stuck in your head could be more effective than more traditional campaigns. At one point, while we're talking about trash, how it can collect water and breed mosquitoes,
got a big gulp container there.
He starts spontaneously quoting prevention advice from one of his videos.
Got a tip and toss to avoid an eruption of a species steady creeping since its introduction.
The intersection of hip-hop and insects might seem unusual, but for Lima, it's about combining two of his longtime interests, dating back to high school and college.
During that time period, I was just listening to a lot of underground hip-hop, and the way I keep it real is by rapping about bugs.
And while he does work in vector control, not all of Lima's songs are about bugs causing diseases. One of his first was about cicadas during one of the big 17-year emergences when billions of the red-eyed bugs appear out of nowhere.
I'm loving it, can't get enough of it. Cicadas are my favorite. So the emergence, I savor it. Not the flavor, but the presence of evolution without a logical solution.
That was back in 2004, so he's been doing this for a while now. And Lima says he's almost got enough material to put together an album. His latest is a tribute to the Fairfax County Health Department's 100-year anniversary.
Protect, promote, improve the health and quality of life for people in our community. Make a difference with excellence and integrity, respecting customer service for more than a century.
As for his next project,
the most common vector-borne illness in the United States is Lyme disease, and I think that's probably what's next on the docket for MC Bugsy and Vector Control Video.
Check this list of vaccines that save millions of lives. About to spit them in chronological order through time. Smallpox, rabies, typhoid.
For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Fenston.
AKA diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, tuberculosis, influenza, yellow fever, poliomyelitis, measles and mumps, rubella, anthrax, and meningitis, deadly pneumonia, and adenovirus, hepatitis B.
And later today on All Things Considered, a look at bail reforms in New Jersey, which have essentially eliminated the use of cash bail in the Garden State. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.
A life for people in our community. Make a difference with excellence and integrity. Respecting customer service for more than a century. Protect, promote, improve the health and quality of life for people in our community. Make a difference with excellence and integrity. Respecting customer service.